vaste ervaring.
We are hunters, anglers, riders, and sometimes chefs. Our passion for the outdoor lifestyle motivated the foundation of Harvesting Nature, which serves as a media outlet built to inspire and educate the outdoor expert and novice alike. Our podcast focuses on the technical side of cooking wild fish and game, while also incorporating adventures and lessons learned from our pursuit of wild meat. Join us on our journey of harvesting nature. Hey everyone, this is Justin with the Harvesting Nature Wild Fish and Game Podcast. We're recording remotely this week. We're down in the Everglades in South Florida doing a bit of hunting, or what we like to call hunting, although I don't know how productive we were yesterday or how we will be tomorrow. But we came here to the Everglades Sportsman's and Conservation Club and met with an awesome group of individuals that we wanted to bring on the podcast so we can share some of their history and stories with you. But first off, we'll do kind of an introduction. You guys know me, Justin Townsend, the editor-in-chief of Harvesting Nature. Just kind of bringing you the same wild adventure stories and recipes that you like to see and hear now. And we've got a couple others, so we'll go around.
Hello, my name is Colin. I'm also in the Coast Guard, stationed in Key West with Dustin and Justin here. And I consider myself a pretty novice and learning hunter still, but I'm excited to be out here and to learn from everybody. Thanks for having me on.
And this is Dustin, coming back for the third time with you, contributor. Looking forward to keep going on these little adventures. I learned a lot today, which I can't wait to talk about, and then go into some recipes with you.
And hi, my name is Harry Pickering. I'm the Wildlife Conservation Chairman for the Everglades Conservation and Sportsman's Club, here to talk about a little bit of our history.
Great. And so, just as Harry said, we want to touch on some awesome work that these guys are doing and their history down here in the Everglades. They've been around for about, what, 70 years now?
Since 1950.
Okay, so roughly in that area. And for those that haven't been to the Everglades or know where it is, basically it encompasses the southern southwest tip of Florida, you would say?
Correct.
And it's a very unique ecosystem. Nothing like it exists in the United States, anywhere else. And it's gone through a lot of environmental and conservation changes throughout the years, which makes it really a hot spot for both people local to Florida and then those that have that eye for environmental concerns, conservation concerns, hunting, fishing, all those things here. And there's some really great stuff going on here that I'll go ahead and let Harry highlight.
Okay. Well, beginning in the early 1950s, our club's greatest contribution to wildlife conservation included a number of projects to improve wildlife habitat, including the stocking of big game animals and birds, controlling the number of predators, and cooperating with wildlife officers in the enforcement of game laws. The first club project addressed a major concern for providing water for wildlife during periods of drought. Droughts in the early 1950s resulted in a noted decrease in the alligator population, which resulted in fewer gator holes to sustain a variety of wildlife. In 1953, the club relocated approximately 30 alligators throughout the Big Cypress to even out the distribution so the gators could excavate a broader pattern of permanent watering holes. In the 1960s, the club helped the Florida Freshwater Fish and Game Commission in a big game stocking effort, including the release of deer, wild turkey, and wild hogs. In the early 1960s, 20 Texas deer were released north and south of Monroe Station. Throughout the 1960s, the club participated in a five-year program of capturing deer from other wildlife management areas and making yearly releases into the Big Cypress. In 1969 and 1970, the club attempted to help game populations by controlling predators. A number of bobcats were live trapped and removed from the Big Cypress. Drought conditions recycled nearly two decades later, so the club began a waterhole blasting project in 1971. 20 waterholes, one section per land, were blasted 1 mile east and west of the range line 33, north and south of Monroe Station. The holes start 5 miles north of Monroe Station and follow the range line for 15 miles. In addition, a cluster of 10 to 15 holes were blasted 2 miles south of Monroe Station along the same range line and 2 miles east of Loop Road. The watering holes averaged 12 to 15 feet in diameter and 6 to 9 feet deep. During periods of low water and drought, the watering holes supported large concentrations of wading birds and numerous alligator nests. Beginning in 1974, with the creation of the Big Cypress National Preserve, the National Park Service gradually assumed the role of wildlife and habitat management. The last club project following the creation of the preserve was assisting the Game Commission in relocating 20 deer from Merritt Island to the area of Monroe Station. Since then, the focus of our club's wildlife conservation efforts has been centered on promoting recreational access, involvement in the wildlife management area, and protecting the rights of sportsmen. The club is affiliated with the Everglades Coordinating Council and the National Rifle Association, and club representatives serve on the National Park Service Off-Road Vehicle Advisory Committee. To date, our club members host an annual cleanup along Loop Road and on designated off-road trails.
So we initially came out here earlier today and met with you and got a cool tour of the facility here, which, to give everybody the picture, just kind of geographically, so you mentioned Monroe Station there, so the club's situated just south of Monroe Station, which is on Highway 40.
Loop Road is County Road 94.
Okay.
And we're just south of U.S. Highway 41, Tamiami Trail.
Okay.
So we're about, if you're going from Miami heading west to Naples, we're about two-thirds of the way across the state.
Okay. And just to kind of paint the picture of where we are sitting right now, we're staring at a crackling fire. Some of us are staring. Two of us are staring at it. You guys have your back to it. There's a swamp buggy, which we'll talk a little bit about later because we just had a ride on one. It's my first time.
It's a whole other animal.
Yeah, it was quite the experience. But to definitely loop back around, mentioning some great conservation pieces. So the deer population in the area has kind of struggled, waxed and waned over the years. And I think now it's fair to say that everybody we've talked to here at the club and then when we were out hunting today, it's kind of leaning towards a period where there's not as many deer as there once were, sort of as these conservation efforts grew and we saw their maximum efforts, essentially?
Correct. The number of deer harvested each year has gone down steadily for the last 5 to 10 years, gradually. But the harvest is getting fewer and fewer deer.
Now, do you think that's more because of the habits and behaviors of people or other natural predators?
It's got to do with high water. We've had a number of hurricanes in 2017 and 2018, and has to do with predators, you know, the pythons that everybody's heard about. The habitat just doesn't support
just so many different stressors,
a sustainable amount of game population.
And the habitat itself, the Big Cypress Wildlife Management Area or Preserve, it's such a huge chunk of the area. And just to kind of drive, to give you perspective of driving, so we started on the easternmost tip of it today on the south, drove all the way to the western side, and it probably took us, what, about 30, 45 minutes?
Yeah, probably about 45 minutes.
And then we turned to the north and ran up to the north, crossing I-75, and then there, it still took us about another 30 minutes. So you can imagine traveling at 55, 60 miles an hour. You're looking at it's several miles wide, and it's divided up into several units amongst that, which have different game management procedures and policies and directives that help the Park Service and the FWC manage the population here. But all these other outside factors are sort of coming and playing into it with environmental concerns, with the introduction of invasive species. All these things are affecting the population of deer here, which is disheartening to hear, because from a lot of Florida hunters you hear, oh, there's a struggle with big game hunting, you know, quote unquote, we'll say like Western thought of big game hunting, whitetail hunting, wild pig populations are out of control in some areas, in control in some areas, which this is an area to highlight the conservation efforts to eradicate the wild pig. I think there was a lot of historical trends where people were getting rid of these pigs on, you know, as many numbers as they can. And now, you know, going around the park today and then talking with other people, like, we're not seeing any sign. We're not seeing any pig. People are like, they're not here like they used to be. And
you can see the frustration on their face, too. You know, they're just, people are confused.
Well, it's an interesting kind of paradox or conundrum, or however you want to call it, because, I mean, the goal of the wild pig program was to eradicate the wild pigs, destroying people's crops. But at the same time, now that it's been successful and there aren't as many pigs around, people who are like us who come up for the recreation and the hunting looking for wild pigs, they're not able to be found. So it's kind of a catch-22.
So in some places, it's been ingrained in the culture. Like here, you guys have the wild pig roast that you do every year. So it began as a wild pig roast and now it has evolved into something different, which we'll touch on the event and kind of give a plug for that here a little later. But just really curious, the whole thought of like hunting and fishing in the Everglades, to me, I always pictured in my mind coming to South Florida, going to Key West, like we zipped over to the national park, all that down south, and it just put a different mental image in my head of when we came to Big Cypress. And to see and hear how the club has been involved in a lot of conservation efforts over the year, even establishing. So a lot of the land, who controlled a lot of the land before the state took it over and turned it into the preserve?
Well, there was private property and also a lot of land owned by the state of Florida. In the 1950s, the state of Florida also entered an interagency, an agreement with local landowners and ranch owners to form the first wildlife management area, the state wildlife management area back in the 1950s, called the Big Cypress Wildlife Management Area. And that was the predecessor to the Big Cypress National Preserve.
And so something interesting I learned today is that in the preserve itself, there still exists chunks of private property that are only accessible via the off-road vehicle trails. And I think it was explained to me most clearly is if you had someone who had deeded property, it was deeded by the county, then whenever they formed the preserve, you got to, your land was reduced, given to the preservation, but you were still allowed to keep like 3 acres?
Right. 1974, when the Congress passed the act, the public law creating the Big Cypress National Preserve, part of the act included that any landowners would be allowed to keep 3 acres of land as long as that land, they had a deed to that land and it was recorded on the county tax rolls. So any land that was on the tax rolls prior to 1974 in the Big Cypress National Preserve, at that time, landowners were allowed to keep 3 acres. There is another area that was added in the 1980s called the Big Cypress Additions Unit, and that's a different date. I forget exactly what the date is, but it was like 1980 or close to 1980, where any landowner in that, the Additions Unit, was allowed to keep 3 acres of land. So if you had a camp and, you know, was recorded on the tax rolls, you're allowed to keep 3 acres. Any of the trespass camps, there were a lot of camps out here where sportsmen just erected a camp and hunted out of that camp. Those camps were destroyed.
Okay. And so the existing 3 acres that you see, a lot of that your members have deeded to, and they have access to that kind of right through the management system of the club. Looking back at the numbers, I'm curious to hear some of the harvest numbers that you have.
2016, there was over 100 bucks harvested, but then we had Hurricane Irma, and we had horrific flooding in the Big Cypress and the Everglades, and also part of archery season was canceled because of the storm. And there, that year, in 2017-2018, there was only 67 bucks harvested. This year, I don't know what the tally is, but it's probably online to be at least that.
Sure. And so looking at why we're only highlighting the buck numbers is there's a restriction on within Big Cypress and this zone, an antler restriction that is very specific on what you can harvest. So that's also limiting on number to help raise population so they don't allow does to be taken. They have an early season quota management, which is Florida's way to regulate early harvests. And so you enter a drawing, much like you do in the western states, to get early access, usually like first harvest picks on those bucks that you're going with. And that helps, I think, helps keep the number low, but also regulate and population growth so that...
Well, the opening weekends of general gun is always the heaviest hunting pressure. So there's quota permits issued for the first 9 days of hunting season in the Turner River unit. Okay. So you have to apply for a quota permit. If you don't have the quota permit, you got to wait 9 days, and then you can access the Big Cypress to hunt.
So difference, do you know difference in success rates as far as the guys coming, or not guys, individuals coming in on that first 9 days versus, you know, later in the season? Like, we're in the last week of the season. Right now, it ends January 1st. Season closes, but we've had, you know, since before that early period, people have been in and out of the woods and talking with the check-in station here, probably lowest he's seen in 3 years.
Yes, but archery and muzzleloader, if you combine archery and muzzleloader together, they probably outnumber the number of bucks that were taken during general gun. So if you get a head start and get your stand out in the woods and you're hunting earlier in the year, archery and muzzleloader, you stand a decent shot at harvesting a buck.
Okay, so can you explain to everyone and to us a little bit kind of the process? So we were out today on one of the roads just north of where we're camping at and walking. We passed a lot of the off-road vehicles and stuff. And those guys, some of them had stands. Some looked like they were just cruising around, sort of quote-unquote like road hunting, just looking for animals, and then would move off the road and sort of pursue them. But what's the normal method of hunting here?
Well, the average hunter who has an off-road vehicle will, depending on whether it's an ATV or a UTV or a swamp buggy, they will travel back into the backcountry as far as they can go and then walk off the off-road trail and start scouting. You know, of course, when you start scouting, just like any other area you hunt in the United States, you want to look for game trails and tracks, and if you can zero in on some game trails and tracks, you know, I like to try to find several intersecting tracks. Sometimes you can find, you know, two or more game trails that intersect. And if you see fresh tracks, you know where to start. And then you start expanding your search looking for scrapes and rubs. And if you do find scrapes and rubs, then you set up in that area. But what the problem is in the front country, there's so much hunting pressure where the off-road trails are. Unless you get back in the backcountry more than a mile off of the trails or 6, 8, 10 miles back, you're gonna be walking over each other. Tree stands everywhere, hunters and vehicles. And
it's not easy country to move around in either.
No.
Like it's pretty thick.
And there's only a limited number of trails, and that's the problem. You know, that leads to high concentration on the number of hunters along the off-road vehicle trails.
Do you think people hunting from primarily walking in that short distance to from the trails and then the possibly like an increased amount of off-road vehicles throughout the years as it's moved deer and deer have relocated, that's contributed to the drop in harvest?
I don't know.
Okay. I mean, I think it could be considered one of the factors. I mean, there's many other, and playing, this being well, such a...
Years ago, secondary trails were open, but then some environmental groups filed a lawsuit against the National Park Service, and there was a settlement agreement, which never came to fruition, but the lawsuit kind of came to a conclusion with the Park Service agreeing that they would not pursue reopening any secondary trails. So you just had the primary off-road vehicle trails, and that leads to that super concentration of hunters in the woods.
I think we saw some of those today, the closed trails marked with either a red or an orange tag. And
yep.
Yeah, so we were looking at some of those as it might be some good areas to go out and scout and then come to find out they're closed. And, you know, we don't want to be trespassing where we're not supposed to.
Yeah, I mean, we traveled in about 3 miles today by foot.
Before
we decided to turn around. And it was, you know, right now it's almost January. It was probably a high of 82 today.
Yeah,
roughly.
Somewhere around that.
Humidity was probably at 70%, rain showers throughout the day. So it's even late season in South Florida, it's not easy hunting anything you do, which is very contrary to a lot, I think, the way us three I know hunt. You know, Colin hunting recently, most in Colorado, Dustin in Missouri, and myself in Wyoming.
Well, you know, it's a whole other animal hunting out here. When you go to like the Southwest, you can do a lot of spot and stalking, set up that way, get to an area, do a lot of glassing, and then go from there. You go up to, let's say, where I hunt in Missouri, there's a lot of just, you look for your trails, you find everything, and you set up a stand and wait. Out here, you got to go find it, and it's not easy.
Yep.
And that's why, I mean, if you haven't heard of these swamp buggies, it's one of the most vital tools of getting you out there. And this is they're on a whole new level. So a swamp buggy is basically, the best way to describe it is like a small skeletalized monster truck. It's souped up. Like if you just imagine a pontoon boat top on a monster truck bottom.
Looks like something out of Mad Max.
There's no regulations. Each and every single one of them is, it's like a thumbprint. Like everyone is different, and it's truly amazing. And it's one of the most fun things we've done. We just went out and you were kind enough to give us a ride on those. That was great.
Well, there is some regulation. You can't have tires. You can't have chains on the tires, and the tires have to be a minimum of 10-inch width on the ground.
Okay.
And it's the National Park Service that regulates that, right? Because you have to have the permit in order to get into the backcountry. And so you'll see some photos on our Instagram as we kind of toured around today. We snapped some photos of some of the swamp buggies, which we'll post, and you can see the creative, artistic flair of an Everglades swamp buggy, which I think is really cool because the way it's described, the engine is sort of encapsulated so that water can't intrude and into the engine and prevent it from running, which is really awesome because people also think of, you know, the Everglades and think flooded constantly. Here, I think we're in the driest part of the year. Coming into the drier part of the year. And in the summer, when it's heavy rains, the water's rising, but you still have the ability to use these swamp buggies.
And then there's the holes. You always got to contend with the sloughs. Every time you come across a slough, that area will be lower elevation than the prairie. And so you've got, you know, some, you know, high water areas that you have to traverse through as you move from, you know, through the preserve from slough to slough across prairies and across pine islands and then back into a slough and so forth.
It's really the terrain here, being on the ground, because we looked at it via like Google Earth and Onyx Maps, and you see kind of just you can tell there's clusters of trees, clusters of pines, maybe cypress, but you can't really see the contour, which isn't as great just looking at it straight as you would see. I mean, because I think we looked at one point today and we were like 10 feet above sea level, but even that area during the rainy season could have water in it at 10 feet above.
Yeah, we were walking on prairie grasses and open prairie fields with clear crawfish shells in it, snail shells in it. I mean, you can definitely see where the water line was, but there's nothing to be found there right now.
Yeah, and coming across. We saw very little sign for deer as we were moving around. Some buck tracks we followed for a while, but they kind of dipped into some pines and...
Some bear sign, right?
Bear sign, yeah, with some bear scat, which is bears are prevalent here.
Yep. Yeah, the big cypress, bear hunting is illegal in Florida.
Yeah.
There was a few years, there was 1 year that it was opened up in the last 5 years, but then prior to that, it hadn't been open for 15 or 20 years. But yes, there's an abundance of bear in the Big Cypress National Preserve.
Now, let me ask you this. I've seen a lot of signs for panthers. How big of a problem is that?
The roadkill is the biggest problem. I mean, yeah, panthers are nocturnal. Very few people ever will see a panther during their lifetime. But the problem is, you know, the superhighway and the interstate, you know, animal crossing the highway, you know, they have no defense. And, you know, I don't know what the roadkill is, but there's, you know, several dozen panthers killed every year by motor vehicle collisions.
And they're federally protected here, right?
Yep.
So in a lot of other states, the state may have protections, but I think this is one of the most unique places where they're federally protected due to their unique...
Yep. Yeah, it's a subspecies of the western mountain lions.
So you said maybe 10 or 12 roadkills a year involving Florida panthers?
No, probably more than that, several dozen.
Oh, wow. So that's just from our basic research today, that's a pretty significant amount. Okay. That's a pretty significant amount of their population that falls to roadkill.
And I think, so we were driving on the western side of the preserve. There's like big high fences and a lot of signs out there saying, you know, this is a wildlife corridor. They have underpasses, just like in a lot
panther
of
crossing.
Panther crossing, bear crossing, which would help alleviate. Because the other places where we didn't see it, too, even alligators. Like we saw... Dustin, you were commenting on the number of alligators.
Yes, there's a large amount of alligators out there.
A large amount of large alligators.
Yes, I mean, I'm talking little Godzillas everywhere.
Yeah, the wildlife crossings under the highways do work. They're effective.
Absolutely. I've seen them, you know, in the western states, a lot of the states are beginning to implement them and seeing the positive results here as well. We even went through on the Bear Island unit. They have an access gate, but it's still a high fence gate. And they're like, visitors are welcome, but please close the gate behind you. And that helps. So the areas where you're not seeing those highway crossings, like I think roadkill wise, we saw alligators, we saw, other slew of animals in there. And I think having those higher fences kind of around the area. And people think a lot of times a negative connotation when it comes to the high fences and sort of keeping animals in, but in this case, it's kind of doing them good because it's taking very delicate species and protecting them from probably one of their biggest predators, which is, you know, vehicles on the road who, you know, just happen to be traveling along.
And I'd like to say, like, for anyone who, you might not even be interested in hunting in the Everglades, but you still got to come out here and check it out. It's just wonderful seeing these animals in their natural habitat. I'm talking 12-foot alligators, maybe even bigger, sitting on the side of the road. It's something else down here.
Well, it's beautiful, the terrain and the habitat, and the amount of wildlife in terms of birds. I mean, it's a bird watcher's paradise. And small animals also, like I mentioned earlier today, where my tree stand is in the stair steps unit, there's a fox squirrel's nest right behind my tree stand. Always see a big cypress fox squirrel, which is a species of concern. And just some very unique animals. I mean, it's animals and bird life. It's beautiful. And the sunrises, the sunsets are gorgeous. But you got to contend with the heat and the bugs and the mosquitoes and... hunting during archery and muzzleloader, I not only carry in my backpack a thermocell, but I also have a full bug tamer suit, both pants and jacket, which is a mesh that's covered by a mosquito net. And so I use a bug tamer, suit, my thermocell, and mosquito repellent, and full gloves during archery season.
Do you see them? Do they come in like clouds?
Or? Well, it's just, you know, you can't avoid them. I mean, they get in between your eyeglasses and your eyes, and so, yeah, you got to protect yourself against the bugs during archery. First couple weeks of muzzleloader until the water levels drop, and then this year we've been lucky. This year, halfway through muzzleloader season, the bugs weren't too bad.
Now, one thing we're talking about in a little while is we're going on to invasive species. What would you say? We're talking about the pythons today. But how big of a problem is that?
Well, it's huge. I mean, out here at the hunting club, our caretaker ran over one on our access road and killed it after he ran over it, and another club member killed one. The majority of the Burmese pythons, and there's a few other subspecies, but the majority of them are in the Florida Everglades in the sawgrass. And the state of Florida, both the South Florida Water Management District and the Florida Wildlife Commission, they have teams, and there's over 50 licensed, you know, persons that have the license to capture the python and then dispatch it. And I believe the last that I read, it's well over 3,000 have been killed since the program started years ago. But each snake, as I understand it, each female can lay up to 80 to 100 eggs a year.
That's insane. That's so many eggs.
There's all sorts of programs going on. There's this one program based out of Naples. What they do is they call it the Sentinel Snake. They put in transmitters on the females, and they track the females during the breeding season. The idea is to capture as many males as you can that are getting to these pods for breeding.
We saw some of the pictures because we were talking when we checked in. You have to check in each morning here or check in before you go, like for several days. And they had photos of the trackers and like the red bands identifying the females that have the tracking devices on them. And he's like, you know, you're free to shoot any of the others that you see out, just the ones with the red bands, don't do that because they have a specific season where they come out when I would say probably they're mating. And he said they harvest anywhere from up to 10 to 15.
I've yet to see one. I can't wait to get my first python. And if you get one, you record the GPS coordinates, take a picture, and you send it to the Game Commission webpage, and they send you a free T-shirt that says, I got one.
We were talking, I think we heard that, I think it was the Meteor podcast, they were talking about, or no, Kyle's Week in Review, they were talking about the T-shirt, and we were discussing it on the way up from Key West as we were traveling.
Well, I'd love to get one. I want to get the skin, and I would like to try some recipes.
It's interesting that you say that, because just when we were out riding on the Swamp Buggy, our driver was talking about how, you know, since the decline of the deer population and the wild hog populations, and the harvests have been pretty low in the past few years, that the his next big trophy is going to be a Burmese python, which is interesting because it's invasive and it's a pest and it's a nuisance to everybody.
So you mentioned that you want to get one and you'd like to eat it. So we have an invasive problem too down in the Keys. We have iguanas everywhere.
Yep.
Massive,
yep.
And they get big.
Yep.
And you'll see some of the pictures later on the website.
Pellet guns.
Yeah, pellet guns, bow.
Yeah.
They're big enough. You can hit them with a bow. But what we do is we can eat them as well.
Yeah.
So what we do is we'll take the iguanas, and one of my favorite recipes is iguana tacos.
Wow.
So that'll be posted on the webpage as well.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it's pretty simple to make. Now, what you do is you boil it for an hour after taking it, right? You skin it, and these things are big enough. If you want to try something, experiment, try.
Yeah. Do you have a picture, Dustin?
I do have a picture.
Show us the picture so we can see.
We'll post this on the webpage as well.
You'll see it go up with the recipe.
Down there, when they get big, they get nice and orange.
So wow. You can see that thing
is... Oh, my God.
The body of it is almost the length of my torso.
Jesus.
So they're pretty big. They're heavy.
Nice fillet.
Yeah, there's a good amount of meat that comes off it, too. Obviously, the tail, but when they get that big, you can also take down the back. And what you do is you boil it for about an hour, or at least an hour, I should say. And once you do that, you want to take a fork and kind of shred the meat out, right? And I like the meat all down the backbone, and then the first part of the tail,
right.
That's the best of it. And then what you do is you take a nice pan. I prefer cast iron, but it doesn't really matter. I take a pan, and I take coconut milk, right? I take mango slices cut up, and I continue to cook it in the pan. So now I have my coconut milk in there. I add a little bit of Cajun spice and some fresh cracked pepper, and I cook that for about 10 minutes. After I've done that, then what I'm going to do is I take a regular small little tortilla, right? I take it out with it still has the sauce and the mango slices. I add it to the tortilla, and then I give it a little bit of avocado slices cut thin, a little bit of parsley, and then you can shred some cheese of your choice on it. And I tell you what, it's fantastic.
Wow. It's surprising.
I'm sure you could do something similar with pythons out here, too. I mean, reptile meat, it's pretty similar.
It's either History Channel or National Geographic. I think it's History. It's called Guardian of the Glades, and the python hunter's name's Dusty Crumb. And so there's season two is starting like next week. And he has a couple of recipes and has cooked python.
I heard it's turned into a very lucrative business, python hunting.
Oh yeah,
I was seeing the National Park Service is offering an hourly rate plus money paid by foot.
Yeah, it's not a lot of money, but it's just knowing that you're doing something to help the environment and Florida wildlife.
Harry, what's the biggest alligator you've seen down here?
I've seen so many. Everywhere in Florida. So, I don't know, 12, 13 feet, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I don't pay attention to them anymore, except for one that I stepped over walking out of my tree stand one morning. It was a little moonlight, little crescent moon, just a little bit of moonlight, and I was walking across the slough, and I stepped over this log, and I thought for a second, I go, damn, that log wasn't there yesterday, and I turned back, and it was a freaking, 10, 12-foot alligator that just stepped over the back of. And then another time, I was out duck hunting, and I was working my way, decided to take a shortcut to get across this cut canal, and I got up on near the levee, and there was an area where the grass was a little bit lower, and I stepped out, and the grass was mashed down, and I looked down, and I'd stepped right in the middle of an alligator nest, and the first thing I was looking for was the female alligator. It was during nesting season, during duck season, and man, I took off, and I made it across the cut to canal to the levee in like 10 seconds.
Now, for the most part, other than nesting, they're more afraid of us than we are of them. Is that correct?
I don't know.
I don't know, man. We saw that one today.
That I don't know.
He got a little close, but for the most part, it seems like they just kind of mind their own business.
Did I tell you we saw one today?
Yeah.
It was a little one, I think. Yeah. What's the rule of thumb?
Is it number of inches between the nose and the eyes is about how many feet long it is?
Wow. So I don't think it was much. Maybe like...
Nose to tail.
Right. Maybe like 5-6 inches, so I don't know. That still seems big in my head. But it, all I saw as we were walking, there was a small little pool on the side of the road, and I just see I don't see its body, I just see the tail slide in the water, and then his head pops up, and he starts like swimming towards us, and it's probably only about 10, 15 feet across this little this little area, and then he disappeared. We were like, all right, we'll just keep walking. But it's something I don't encounter too much in the wild. In most of the places. So it's unique. And coming here, you always have thoughts of like, oh, snakes, alligators, spiders, everything. But overall, not as, I don't want to say scary and sound like a wimp, but not as like, not as threatening as what I would think. It's actually really peaceful here, which I like. And parts of it remind me of where I'm from in Oklahoma, the prairie parts of it. And then you have little pockets of pines and other trees around, and that sort of, we don't have the flooding that would come in the summer, but those very similar in my mind of like the rural parts where I grew up. It's all the swamp buggies and four-wheelers, ATVs that are departing the camp right now. So because we're still in an active camp, so everyone's leaving where we are right now, except for us. And
it's very interesting to see those swamp buggies. I'm absolutely amazed.
Love them.
That ride was pretty incredible.
I will have one day.
Are you going to build one?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you could build one out of spare parts and
around Key West.
Well, he said it's the same, so the engine's the same height as a truck. It's just it's cased, and then they just raise it up and then attach the bed on there. Hey, Dustin, you got the fire over there. You know what it reminds me of?
What's it remind you of?
It reminds me of the Traeger. Cooking food on the Traeger, right?
Right.
Nice smoky flavor. And you recently had some.
I did. And it was really good, and I can't thank you enough for that. But more importantly, I'm amazed by those grills. It's been a while, so I've been stuck in my ways. I got my old chamber smoker. Seems to always do me right. Even experimented with a little upright pellet smoker. A little bit better. But then I saw this Traeger, and it's just fantastic.
Precise, which is what's most important to me. In all the cooking I do and all the cooking I've done, it's been sort of a very dependable piece of equipment in my kitchen. Colin's also had an experience with a Traeger recently, too.
Yeah, this is true. A few months ago, I ended up having to cook a few pounds of meat for a wedding rehearsal dinner, and it was all going to be cooked on the Traeger. And it was my first time using a Traeger, and it was super easy to use. All I had to do was throw the meat on top, set the temperature, and let it go from there, and it turned out great. It was a huge hit.
You know what my favorite thing about Traeger is?
Tell me it's the Wi-Fi.
The Wi-Fi is a great thing, but I like the pellets, the variety of pellets. Our local hardware store in Key West, and I think a lot of others in and around town, plus online too. I think Amazon, you can get them.
They're affordable.
Traeger.
They're easy to find.
There's like many, many different flavors, and it's great because you can pair different flavors of the pellets with different flavors of meats. And then in addition to that, Colin came over for Christmas dinner, and we had the wild game rub. It was pretty incredible. We had that on the goose.
Yeah.
And we also use the Saskatchewan seasoning. We use
and
that
salmon,
on
right?
Salmon. Yeah, it was pretty good. So
and the ham, too. Ham was in there also.
The ham we put in there. We didn't use seasoning on the ham. We just smoked
it straight,
which
still,
came out fabulous.
Came out, excellent.
And just to be able to have a great piece of equipment like that in the kitchen is awesome. And I look forward to every day I get a chance to use it and find new ways to be creative with it. So, now to do closing, we've talked a lot, touched some on invasive species, we've talked about pythons, talked about hunting in the Everglades, the Everglades Sportsman's Conservation Group. We are happy to have Harry joining us today, giving us the rundown on what's going on here in the Everglades and hoping to inspire some new interest and some new attention and love. And foster old attention and love for this really awesome, unique place. So we'll just kind of go around and do takeaways. So, Colin, you go first. You got alibis, misfires, anything?
No, not much. Just kind of to reiterate what we said earlier, this is a really unique place, and it's unlike any place that I've ever hunted in. We usually have the mountains and some kind of hill or elevation to give yourself an advantage, and here it's really just... you're on the same level as the environment, so you don't really have an advantage, especially with the heat and the water and the different how the land changes throughout the year. It's really challenging.
And mosquitoes.
And mosquitoes. I think I've killed about 15 since I've been sitting here. So.
Harry, do you have any last thoughts for us?
Our club is hosting the 70th annual Wild Hog Barbecue and Jamboree on Saturday, February 29th. It's going to be here at the Hunt Club at Monroe Station on Loop Road, just south of Tamiami Trail, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. We're going to have a live band. The band is Cowboy Up. Your admission includes a full meal, ribs, chicken, coleslaw, baked beans, and all the fixings. There's going to be lots of vendors. We're going to have lots of exhibitors. The Miccosukee Tribe of Indians will be here with a food concession, Indian fry bread, turnovers, lots of stuff going on. We're going to have a turkey shoot. We'll have skeet shooting, free swamp buggy rides.
Yes.
Throughout the property. We have 40 acres here. We'll take you on a long, fun swamp buggy ride.
We're going on that tonight. It's totally worth it. That alone is worth coming out. Even that, compared with all the other great activities that are coming out, I think we'll be here for sure. I think I'm gonna bring the kiddo out and the family. And we'll...
Yeah, this is going to be a big year. We got a lot of big sponsors, and it should be a great time. We're expecting anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000 people.
That's a lot.
So if you get here, get here early, you know, so you can park up close. We will have shuttles running back and forth to pick up guests, running up and down Loop Road to the gate, to the front gate. So please come out and join us.
Nice. Dustin, last thoughts?
Thanks for listening. It was good to share this experience of hunting and exploring the Everglades with you, and I can't wait for our next adventure.
Yeah, I'm really excited that we got the opportunity to come here just for the weekend. I'm a little saddened that it's the last week of deer season that we got to come down, but definitely have the opportunity to come next year, I think, and hope to meet up.
Spring Gobbler.
That's right. March.
Small game, duck February, season. March.
Oh, yeah. So there's time. There's still time, and we're going to make it out. We were already talking today about what our next plans are going to be, and I'm pretty excited to get back out because I really enjoyed being here.
I'm going duck hunting next and then spring gobbler.
Nice. We got duck hunting coming up. And there you go. You hear the four-wheelers again. Like I said, we're sitting in an active camp. Everybody's out enjoying themselves.
That's such a satisfying noise.
It is, especially when it's a small buggy.
So we're duck hunting, too, in January, which is going to be cool. That's going to be our next adventure. Hopefully, got a buddy out to come shoot a little film for us. But I just want to put a quick plug in for the podcast. Thanks everybody who's been listening to us thus far, and we really appreciate your comments and support that have been coming in. If you have any questions, concerns, feedback, fact checks, send it to whatscooking@harvestingnature.com, and we'll take a look at that, and we'll speak to it on our next episode. And always, whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on, be sure to subscribe and click those 5 stars. Give us a positive review if you like our content. Once again, this is the Harvest of Nature crew and Mr. Harry coming to you from the Everglades.